Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello, and welcome to New Horror Express, your weekly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm talking to director Zach Lempelew about his debut feature, wait for it, 15 Things You Didn't Know About Bigfoot, number one will blow your mind. Over the course of the interview, you will hear me talk to Zach about the origins of the film and how himself and lead actor Brian Ewan in the script set out to satirize Vice News and the like, as well as that, how they were made to change the movie's title from the original title, The Vice Guide to Bigfoot. The title can actually still be found on IMDb right now, which is wrong. Your IMDb, you should change that. We also talk about the dangers of making not only a found footage movie, a subgenre that many would argue has become somewhat oversaturated, particularly in the last decade, but a Bigfoot movie, which is a subgenre that is just filled with a lot of rubbish movies, just a lot of bad stuff. But they somehow make it work, man. It's a good movie. So, you know, sometimes these things can happen. Plus, we talk about the film's many influences, including the possibly most surprising one in the form of pop star Never Stop, Never Stopping, and how COVID majorly affected their festival run, sadly. But it's still getting out there, so that's still good times. You can hear all of this and much, much more in my interview with Zach right now. Hi, Zach. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hey, how are you?
Good. And so we have you on the show today to talk about 15 things you didn't know about Bigfoot, brackets. Number one, will blow your mind, close brackets. So tell us, let me say that again, give us a little brief synopsis, spoiler free, for the listener, of 15 things you didn't know about Bigfoot, brackets, number one, will blow your mind, close brackets.
So, my movie, 15 Things You Didn't Know About Bigfoot, number one will blow your mind, is it's a movie I directed with some friends, and it's about a guy who is working at one of these cool millennial news outlets. He has what you would think is like a cool, fun job, and but he's always having to be, he's always forced to cover these things like, I had to spend a week with nudists and here's what it's like, or, you know, I went vegan for 30 days and here's blah blah blah. And like, so he kind of hates his job. He feels like he could be doing more with his life, and his latest assignment is that he has to go follow Bigfoot hunters for a week and report back on what that's like. But once he gets into the woods, he finds out that maybe there's more than meets the eye. Got to work on my pitch for that. I haven't had to pitch it in a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that gives a nice summation of what happens there. So yeah. What was the initial inspiration behind the script of the film, which you wrote with the lead actor, Brian Ewan?
Yeah, so for the movie, we wanted to make a movie, period. So we kind of put the cart before the horse, maybe. We were just like, we want to make a movie. We had made probably like 100 shorts at that point. We'd made a ton of shorts, and we kind of knew what worked for us and what didn't. We needed to tackle something bigger, because we'd been into a bunch of meetings that led to nothing, you know, and that'll take up months of your life. So we were like, what's the movie that we can make, that we can afford, that we can do? And we just like set a deadline, and we're like, we can do it like this fall. And then we started trying to figure out what it would be about. And, you know, we both hate like these cool vibe companies, you know, like like cool places to work. It's all just kind of a scam, you know? So we wanted to tackle that as a theme. And we'd actually been, we actually had this like inside joke we would do where Brian would just start doing that voice. Like we would be somewhere and Brian would be like, I don't know, maybe it's fun. Maybe we'll find out right now. We'll go inside, join us. Like, in, I don't know, just mocking whatever we would see when we're out and about. So yeah, so we were like, let's just make fun of, like Vice News basically. And we made a whole movie about it. So yeah, that was pretty much what we wanted to aim for. And you know, we love like horror movies, found footage movies, comedies. And I don't, has there been, there's been a couple like found footage comedies, but you know, we wanted to make a movie that we would like to see.
Yeah, but you just, I was just kind of thinking, yeah, there are, I suppose, yeah, there's been, there's not, it's not a massive segment of the subgenre, has to be said. There's only a couple found
there's footage. There's been mockumentaries. Like, there's definitely like Parks and Rec falls into mockumentaries.
Oh, yeah, well. No, I mean, there's a lot, I mean, mockumentaries are kind of there. I mean, since Spinal Tap, there's been a you know, whole,
yeah, there hasn't been a lot of found footage comedies where like the cameraman is also a player in this.
Yeah, there's like, it's, but like in terms of like crossing over between the kind of found footage horror and comedy, it's not, there's not a big Venn diagram there. So in terms of that, how much research did you do in terms of like getting the ticks kind of right, you know, in terms of like watching Vice documentaries? Or there's a, you know, there's also, because you get that quite, you get the vibe of that quite accurate. And it's the same with Jeff's character, where it's like kind of paranormal YouTubers, is like you get the vibe of that, you know, pretty dead on, you know. So did you watch a lot of that stuff in kind of preparation for the movie?
Yeah, so it's always good to go like watch it, especially if you have a question, if you know you're thinking about like, well, how would they handle like this kind of shot? How would they start this? How would they edit this? And like you can go like watch it. But no, I mean, like I had edited cool stuff before, like I've never edited for Vice, but like I'd edited kind of just like hipster millennial documentary kind of stuff where, you know, the producer would be like, this needs to feel more like, you know, spontaneous, like in the edit and stuff. Yeah. And it drives you nuts. But mm-hmm. Also Tim Rice, I'm sorry, I keep saying his name wrong. He is our producer and he helped us shoot the whole thing. And he had actually like shot for Vice before, like a few times. Okay. So he had like, whenever we told him, we were like, we want to make this movie. We want it to look like Vice. We want it to look like something like BuzzFeed would make. And he was like, oh yeah, I have those cameras. Like I shoot stuff for them sometimes. This is exactly what I use. So it worked out perfectly.
Cause it definitely looks like that. It definitely looks quite accurately like that stuff. And yeah, I knew I was going to be on board with the movie where, you know, with that kind of one of those initial gags where Brian is in the Ukraine and you hear all his gunfire and you think he's gonna be like a serious civil war report, and then he's like, oh, let's check out the craft beer scene. I was like, oh, that's good. I like that. That does seem quite accurate. This is skipping forward. We'll skip back to the kind of making of and okay, the process of script to screen, but just skipping forward before we skip back, how pleased were you when some reviewers seemed to genuinely believe it came from Vice?
Oh yeah, I don't know if that helped or hurt us. I would say, okay, Mostly hurt us. But no, it's funny when people believe stuff like that. Yeah, when you put out a lie that's just barely a lie, you know what I mean, like effortlessly, and people buy it, it's like, yeah, it's definitely funny. But then also we found out later we like didn't get into some festivals because they thought it was really Vice, you know, like that. Oh, somebody, okay. Yeah, which sucked. But yeah, somebody hit me on Twitter with like, I added somebody on Twitter just because I saw we followed some of the same people. And he sent me a message that was like, oh, you're the guy from the Vice, the movie, whatever. Yeah, the Vice movie. And That was so funny. Like, we all loved it. Everybody at, you know, Blank Festival really loved it. But, you know, unfortunately, you just already have distribution, so we didn't want to play it. And I was like, we do not have distribution. I made this movie, like, with nobody. So Eddie was like, oh, sorry, man, bummer. Whatever. I mean, he's cool. We're buds now. But yeah, I think that happened a couple times.
Right.
That's life.
And it's out. Was that a driving force behind the name change?
Well, no, just nobody would touch it. Nobody would touch it. And, you know, we were basically told to. I don't want to get too much into details, but, you know.
Okay.
Yep. It was a legal minefield that we were walking through.
Fair enough. We'll wheel back from that. We'll kind of reel backwards in time. And so, yes. Once you had the script that you and Brian wrote, how long did it take roughly from kind of that finished script, that finalized script, into like getting to shoot the film?
So we wrote the script in a few months, like pretty quickly. I mean, because we already knew what we could and couldn't do, and you know, we made this movie really cheaply. So, you know, when you start trying to write set pieces in where you're like, and then they get on an airplane and they go to the different country for the craft beer scene thing, it's like, no, they don't. No, we don't have that. So so we wrote it pretty quickly, and then we shot all of Jeff's stuff in like 2 weeks, which, because we only had him for 2 weeks, he could only get 2 weeks off work. So we shot like 80 pages or something. Like, he's in like 75 or 80 pages of this movie, and we shot it in like 16 days maybe, because it was like 2 weeks for the weekends. And yeah, so we were hustling while he was in town, and then we kind of filled in the rest of it, because there was like maybe 20 more pages, and we filled in the rest of it with like weekends here and there. So it actually kind of like, then it stupidly got spread out. Like, you would think like, oh, we'll just do the remaining 20 pages really quickly, but it just like had more moving parts. Like, there's a ton of characters that are coming in and out of this movie. They're only in it for 2 pages. So you have to like schedule everybody. And so it just became like, it was like 80 pages in like 2 weeks, and then 20 pages over like 4 months. Yeah. But that was an advantage, because I'd never made a movie before. And so when we were making this thing, we could put all of Jeff's stuff together, all of his footage, and then a couple things that we'd shot, and we could like literally fill in the gaps, you know, like kind of making your own puzzle piece. Like, because we could watch, you know, an hour and 10 minutes of a movie and be like, yeah, this like the second half doesn't make sense. The first half is great. We really need to fix this like one scene in the middle. So let's like just go fix that. So it was a good learning experience making 3/4 of a movie and then like looking at it and being like, this sucks, but we can fix this part if we do this thing in the first scene, or like this whole storyline doesn't pay off. So now we need to fix the final scene that we're going to shoot next month. So it was good.
Did you find it a big level up from shooting shorts to shooting your first feature?
It was such a pain in the ass. It was so, like, we thought it was going to be so much easier than it was, because we used to run a show where we would make 2 shorts every month and play them in front of an audience. So we would make 2 shorts, they're about 3 to 5 minutes long each, and we would do that, and we did that until we were like just run totally ragged. Like, we did it for like 3 years straight. And so I was used to like first week of the month, like think of an idea and like get it on paper, you know. Next 2 weeks is just like find a day everybody can do whatever, and then like shoot it on like one day. And then the last week is like editing. And this is all like with a full-time job too. So I was used to like that hustling, and like in a month being like, I made like 8 minutes of content. So I was thinking, I was like, well, 80 minutes, that's like 10 months of work. This will be easy. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, that's simple. I'll be able to handle this. But you just don't take into account having, you know, continuity, having to schedule people and like really not screw it up. Like in a short, if someone's wearing like kind of the wrong shirt, like people can get over it. You know what I mean? But if it's in a movie and you're like, this character is supposed to be mean, but he looks goofy. Like, yeah, it's just it's something you don't want to mess up, especially when it's such a huge, like, undertaking, you know? And yeah, it was tougher than I thought it would be. And then what really sucks is QCing it. What really sucks is like fixing two things and then being like, nah, I got to watch the whole thing again. Like, I've seen this movie so many times.
I often ask this when I realize that the director is also the editor. Is it difficult editing your own work? Because I always imagine it must be in terms of creating enough distance between those two roles of your director's cap and your editor's cap.
Well, so luckily, you know, we've been doing this for years with our shorts. And what I loved about that is we would play it in front of a live audience every month. And we would usually have an audience of about 100 or 120 people come out. And so they're not gonna laugh at something that's not funny. So luckily we had like 2 or 3 years of experience, you know, making something and then showing it to 100 people. And then they laugh at parts that you thought they wouldn't laugh at, or they don't laugh at all, or they, you know, like, so you get, you watch them watch the thing you made, and then you learn what they like. So, you know, you have to, like, you can't be precious about it. If there's something in there that you think is funny and they just don't laugh, well, it's gone. You know what I mean? Like, there's no point in keeping it around if it doesn't add some kind of plot or some kind of setup. So, and that helped a few times. I would sometimes record the audience, and then if the short, like, there was like one time where it just didn't work. Like, I played this thing and it like kind of didn't work, but some of it worked. And then I synced up the laugh track with the short later and went and cut out all the jokes that didn't land. And then I like probably took a whole minute off this thing. And then when I exported it out, I was like, oh, you know what? This is actually pretty solid. Like, this is, all this stuff's going to land. People are going to like this. You know, it was just way too long when I played it there. So all that experience just emotionally helps you get over like what people call killing your babies. So whenever I was making this movie, like there was, you know, you choose your battles and you just don't care as much. Like, you know, I would, you know, show something to people who were in the same office I was working in and be like, is this funny? And they'd be like, eh, I don't know. And I'm like, all right, fine. It's gone. I don't care. You know, like I try to be pretty divorced from it. And being an editor for my day job, I'm just used to that. Like, I'm like, eh, you know, that was a funny thought, but it wasn't working, so it's gone. But it is tough to do that for like a whole feature, you know, because you just want it to be good. That's all you want it to be, is just good.
So there was nothing in particular that you got overly attached to that didn't, like, for example, didn't get a laugh, and you were kind of like, well, fuck you guys. I really like that scene.
Well, no, I think if anything, this was a lesson. This is going to sound so narcissistic, but if anything, this was a lesson in being less, because I realized when making this thing and like showing early cuts to people, like with some scenes, it was like, oh, okay, so this scene is very funny, but isn't adding to the plot. You know what I mean? And pretty soon, like, you can't do that for a whole movie. Even really funny movies have to have scenes that aren't funny, you know, even like screwball comedies. Otherwise, you just kind of wind up with that like Kentucky Fried Movie, where it's just like funny all the way through, but it's hard to sustain for 90 minutes. But so if anything, this was like a lesson in being like, how about we like not be funny? Because it's the easy thing is to just be like, oh, well, we make the scene funny this way and like think of a gag. But the more difficult thing is to focus on like, how would the characters feel? What would make the audience want to follow this person's story for the next 20 minutes until we get to the next thing that like is a big twist in the plot or whatever? So yeah, if anything, this was like, we should tone it down some, you know, because it seems like it's much easier to just be like a gag factory.
Do you feel that the movie over the course of time changed tonally then? It sounds like it was maybe a little goofier, because a lot of the movie is quite dry, and it's got a kind of, there's a lot of kind of dry wit in the humor. And I think a large part of that is to do with Brian's kind of deadpan performance during the movie.
So the early stuff that you were talking about with the craft beer scene and all that was much goofier. Like, that one was always in there, like the craft beer thing, but the rest of those gags, we were gonna have it just be more making fun of the kind of like the Vice headlines that they would cover, which it still is. We still like worked that in, but like it was just gonna be more mocking the news. And then we realized after, like I said, after we watched 3/4 of the movie, you know, we were like, when we shoot this first scene, like we have to really establish that Brian doesn't like his job. So we have to like really make sure that that's the theme in all this, you know? In fact, no, you know what, as a better example is that scene with the rapper at the very beginning, that I don't think that was in the first draft of the script. It immediately was just going to start off with like that craft beer thing and like, you know, isn't this funny, isn't the news funny? And then we were like, no, we need to do something more grounded that shows the themes that we're playing with here, you know, that's a little bit less like just jokes flying at you at 80 miles an hour. Yeah,
in terms of the kind of horror subgenres that you're drawing from, why, you know, were you at all worried about the kind of the areas you were going into? Because like often, you know, found footage is quite oversaturated and Bigfoot movies historically are rubbish. I mean,
yeah. No, we don't. That was a fun pastime because Tim and I would work late on this thing. Tim, by the way, is like, he's a straight up like whore head. He loves like movies where heads go splat and stuff like that. He loves gore stuff. And so he was the guy who was in charge of like the special effects. He was like the guy who was like, no, we're going to make this Bigfoot look cool. Like, this is going to be awesome. And he like got the stunt team and everything. He's awesome. But we would be working late on this thing in post-production and, you know, work till like 11 p.m. or something and go back to his place and have a beer. And he would just put on Bigfoot movies and just trash them. Like, we would be drinking a beer and being like, you know, after editing for, you know, 10 hours. And then, he would just put on Bigfoot movies and be like, this Bigfoot sucks. You know, like, our Bigfoot's awesome. This one, you can see way too much of it. It's obviously a fucking suit, you know. It's way too like lit. You can see there's way too much light on set for this. And he was the guy that was like, no, we're going to make this Bigfoot rock. You know, like, we're going to make this look good.
I've seen a few Bigfoot movies, man. And, you know, it's not a subgenre that's got any classics. And I would say that, in terms of Bigfoot movies that I've enjoyed, I enjoyed your movie, and I interviewed the director of a film called The Man Who Killed Hitler and Then the Bigfoot, and that was pretty cool too. Yeah, it's just not a lot.
Well, that's kind of why I wanted to do it, you know? I mean, like, if you went in any other area, I feel like you'd be stepping on some other movie, you know? If you tried to do... some kind of like possession movie, it's gonna be like, all right, so Exorcist did this, and then also Scary Movie did this, and then, you know, if you went in like a zombie direction, it's like, all right, well, there's been a million of those. There's also Shaun of the Dead. There's even one called Juan of the Dead that I just found out about. That's Hispanic Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah. One of the Dead. I can't remember is that the Cuban? Is it Puerto Rican? Maybe.
I don't know, but isn't it? I think it's supposed to be a comedy, right?
Yeah, no, it's a comedy. It's definitely a comedy. Yeah, I mean, there's so many zombie films.
We're kind of like, well, there's not a lot of Bigfoot movies, and the ones that are around are like mostly crap. So it's like, if we can make one that's like okay, like people would probably dig it.
And, yeah, that is true. There's nobody going to be like, well, you know, I mean, this is fine and all, but The Legend of Boggy Creek.
Yeah, exactly. But there are a ton of people who love Bigfoot. We didn't realize until we were making this that like a ton of people are like Bigfoot fans. There was a guy I met in Kansas City who was like, he gave me a Bigfoot keychain. He was like, man, I just love Bigfoot. Like, you know, I I'll watch anything with Bigfoot in it, you know. Then so, and he like gave me some art. He's a cool artist up there, but like he anyway, it was. I've had several experiences like that where people are just like, oh, I saw Bigfoot in the title. I like gotta watch it. Like I watch every Bigfoot movie. So it's definitely interesting. I didn't know about all these people who are apparently in love with Bigfoot. And a lot more people believe in Bigfoot. I don't know if you guys have that in the UK, Bigfoot believers, but
no, not really.
A lot more people believe in Bigfoot than I thought. And that was an interesting discovery as well. Yeah.
Well, I mean, everybody's got their own kind of mythological creatures, you know?
Yeah.
Not a lot of people. I mean, I feel like it's more outsiders, but there is people who definitely believe in Loch Ness.
Loch Ness monster. Like Nessie, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Everywhere's got their own kind of mythological creatures, and there's always some believers, right? I was going to ask in terms of other concerns, I was wondering how long did it take to kind of nail the tone of the movie? Because I feel like it runs through, you know, each act kind of runs through different tones. It starts as pretty much a straightforward comedy. And then you get the out into the woods with your Bigfoot hunter, and then it goes into kind of more. It becomes more of a horror comedy. You know, there's a definite kind of, and you try to create some tense kind of horror sequences, and then towards the end it becomes something else again that I won't really go into because I don't want to spoil anything. So there's, you know, it's very much three acts that have three kind of different tones. I mean, it still makes sense, but how difficult was it to kind of balance that?
Well, I hope it made sense. I guess I never thought of it in that way before. I hope it was a regular enough experience all the way through. Yeah, as far as nailing like the screenplay structure or like the tone of if it's a comedy or what? I mean,
yeah, finding the kind of balances between genres, I suppose. Of like, kind of nailing that the you know comedy to horror quotient.
So I love like comedy movies, especially one. This is like such a bad genre to be in love with, but I love like comedy movies like mid-2000s to like early 2000s, like that kind of jump into a job. I guess like Anchorman, I love like Dodgeball. I love like that kind of goofy stuff where you know it kind of jumps into just like, well, like in I was about to call it Superstar, which is the one with Will Ferrell where he plays basketball, semi-pro. Like those ones where it's like, so there hasn't really been like a basketball comedy, so we're gonna do a basketball comedy, you know. And like and Dodgeball also jumps into like it's kind of a sports comedy, but like the stakes are really low, or it's kind of a sports like redemption story, you know, but the stakes are much lower obviously than a professional athlete, but they're still real. But yeah, so I guess I just love like those kind of comedies and like the tone in those. And so I guess I was trying to channel that energy when I was doing it. Another one I love is like Popstar. Have you seen Popstar with Andy Samberg?
Oh yeah, the never stopping or what? Yeah, like that's good. I like the Lonely Island stuff and all that. Yeah, it's kind of like it's one of those kind of underseen movies.
Dude, that Popstar, movie is so underrated. Nobody, well, at least, all right. So nobody, I'm early 30s. Nobody my age has seen it. And everybody I talk to who's like 22 is like, oh, Popstar, classic. Like everybody knows it. So it's interesting. I think I have a theory. It's because it came out during the election of 2016. So I think older people were just distracted and didn't check that movie out, unfortunately. But that's like one of the funniest movies that I've seen like in several years, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I didn't see it when it like first came out. Yeah. Like, I mean, like I think I'm maybe even slightly older than you. I'm 35 And yeah, a lot of people I know have not seen this, not seen the film, and I'm like, oh, it's
so good.
It's good film. It like really.
Oh. it is one of those that jumps into like a world where it's like, so this is what pop music's like, you know? It's like, this is exclusively what we're making fun of for the whole time. We're just spoofing like Justin Bieber, Eminem, Linkin Park, like all this kind of stuff. Snoop Dogg's in there. So funny. So good.
Yeah, they're good. I also like the ones that they did for telly as well. The ones, the like tennis one that they did and the Tour de France one that they did.
Which was that for SNL?
I can't remember what they did. It's like they did like, they're like little, they're like long shorts. They're like a basically like a kind of TV episode length, but they're just the one thing.
No, I don't think I've seen this Tour de Pharmacy.
Yeah, Tour de Pharmacy, and then he did like a tennis one that was called Seven Days of Hell or something.
That one. Yeah. I don't think I've seen Tour de Pharmacy. That I gotta check this out. Yeah, so I guess anyway, as far as tone for our movie, that was what I wanted to do, was something that was gonna make people genuinely laugh really hard, you know, have enough of a theme and like a story, and have enough of like commentary on what's going on today with online news and how people feel at work and whether or not that's fulfilling or good for your personality. And so I feel like it has enough to say. It might not be great literature, but I feel like it has enough to say about the millennial experience, but mostly wanted to make people laugh for like, you know, the duration of a movie.
You feel like if it was a mashup, it would be like Pop Star meets Blair Witch meets Bigfoot.
Yeah, I was telling Pete, have you seen that movie Creep on Netflix?
Oh yeah, the what are they called? The Duplass?
Yeah. I was telling people it was Creep meets Pop Star. But okay. But both of those movies are not very popular. So the first rule of pitching is you can't pitch with two movies that aren't like hits. So what was I telling people? I was telling people it was Blair Witch meets What We Do in the Shadows. Right. Smarter.
Yeah, okay.
Even though it's not true.
Just more well-known properties.
Exactly, yeah. So this is Superman meets Jurassic Park meets the Bible.
Where did that come in? Like, just like, that's kind of one of those kind of fun quirks. Like the repeated joke about Jurassic Park, just throwing that one.
Oh, man, I had a friend in college. One of these days he's going to find out this is kind of based on him, but he was, whenever we were writing Jeff's character, we were like, we had to think of just kind of a broad personality for this person. And I was kind of basing it on my friend in college who, really nice guy. I'm not trying to say anything bad about him, but he had a bit of a Napoleon complex when it came to like camping and stuff and being outdoors. He just was the kind of guy that would be like, that's not how you tie a knot. I tie a knot better. And then like, you know, his hammock would fall off the tree while he was sitting in it and stuff. And like, you know, he just had to show you how much better he was. And then he wasn't that much better at it. And, and he also loved Jurassic Park for some reason. So we were like, this is so fitting that like a guy who loves, you know, the outdoors, probably in his mind pretends he's in Jurassic Park, and he's going to let you know that about himself.
I think I like the fact that he keep refuting that he'd seen the film as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's not going to let you know that he didn't think of this.
It was very much his line. I was wondering, did you kind of set out to kind of fool people in terms of like, you know, everybody's, you know, like, you know, Brian uses his real name, you use your real name, Jeff uses his real name.
Yeah. that's, I guess that's, you know what, that's just one more of those things with continuity.
Right.
That there was just so much going on that we were just lazy. You know what I mean? Like, I guess I just didn't want to have to worry about somebody having to call me Steve and then screwing it up later and he calls me, you know, some other name or something. So I was like, you know what, we're just going to use our names. And also for years, we'd been making sketches and shorts and stuff where we just called each other our names. So I probably should have given that more thought. I probably should have been like, no, we should at least make up some names, try to be a little professional about this. Just didn't happen.
And how did the, I mean, obviously yourself and Brian are two of the lead characters. It's it's kind of obvious how you're in the movie. But in terms of the rest of the cast, how did they come together? How did you set up auditions, or was it people that you'd worked with before?
So yeah, pretty much, because we'd made all those shorts, we'd worked with pretty much everybody in the movie. Like, I don't think there was anybody in the movie that was like had not been in a short I'd made before. And so it was always a pretty intimate operation. Like, I'd already had a shorthand with most of these actors, pretty much anybody who had a major role in this, or, you know, like several pages worth of lines. Like, I directed them before, and I knew what they were awesome at, and I knew their limitations. And so I could like play to that. And so I knew, like, you know, this person's going to be perfect for this, or, you know, like, we can definitely throw this person on set and they're going to know exactly what to do with like this part. So, I mean, yeah, we didn't do any auditions. we just told people, like, show up, here's your lines, you know, like, maybe check them out the day before, but you're going to nail this. So yeah, it was great.
And I was also wondering, I mean, obviously many of the movies you've mentioned that you're drawn to, you know, whether it be Pop Star or whether it be Anchorman or Dodgeball, often they've had casts that are known to improvise. Was there much of in the way of improvisation in your movie?
Man, so we get this question a lot, and the truth is, not a lot of improvisation, not a lot of improvising on this thing. We made, like, there's a script. It's not like, I don't know, when I think of improv, I think of like theater improv, where they just get on stage and figure something out. You know what I mean? They're like, who knows? Maybe it's a shoe store. Maybe it's going to be a funeral home. Like, and they just make crap up. So, I mean, with this, like, this was a script that you could like read all the way through. There wasn't like scenes that were like, then two characters walk in and they make some stuff up. Like, it read all the way through. And there was a lot of lines that I was like, no, that line's important. We got to nail that exactly. Cause it like pays off 70 pages down the road. Like, and I feel like I was the one keeping that in my head the whole time. Like, a lot of other people would be like, are you sure? And I'm like, yeah, I'm absolutely sure that you have to say it this way. So yeah. So, I mean, there wasn't a ton of improvising. If there's any, the improvising was all in the middle of the movie, kind of when they're in the woods. That was whenever Jeff and Brian are making a documentary together. That was whenever I was like, all right, we can like have some fun here. You know, like, they were making up a couple gags, and yeah, it was like probably that gag where he's like, do you hear that? Do you hear that? Can you hear that? Like, that was, Jeff did just like make that up. Like, right. I was setting up the camera and they came over and they were like, we have a funny idea. Can we just like take 10 minutes and do this? And I was like, yeah, sure. Whatever. We're just out here in the woods, man. Yeah. So it was, and everybody, by the way, like, or not everybody, but like probably over half the cast are like trained actors. Like, I'm trying to think of everybody, but like a lot of these people went to like conservatories and stuff, or like studied acting in college. Like, they're like theater students. So I feel like that goes against the grain of like what people think. Like, people assume like improvisers do great comedy, but it's like, no, like, I mean, yes, they do. But if you, some of the funniest stuff is like whenever you get like a classically trained actor to do something funny, like Liam Neeson, when he's on the Ricky Gervais show, Life's Too Short. Yeah. Was he on that, or am I thinking of? No, I'm thinking of when he's on Extras on the
Extras.
Ricky
Gervais. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. You get somebody like that who's a classically like trained actor who's been in like a lot of serious stuff, and you're like, can you do like this one goofy thing? Like, they just nail it. Like, it's so funny. So a lot of these people that are in this are in more serious stuff with a lot more weight to their roles, but I was like, nah, you guys are gonna like crush it at this.
I mean, sometimes that is true. Sometimes like straight actors, like, I'm not a big Ricky Gervais fan, but I do remember, I think it is in Extras, that there is one with Ian McKellen, and he's explaining his acting process of like how he got into like Gandalf and stuff like that, and he's just like, I just pretend, you know.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
I just pretend I'm Gandalf. he just continues. So that's, and obviously he's comes from like a kind of Shakespearean background and all that. It's ew.
Yeah, the people like that, if you give them, of course they're going to ask you, you know, what's their motive and all those kinds of like questions. But if you, you know, and that's what you have to do as a director. If you can firmly say like, no, it's funny because of this, like, here's what your character's feeling. And here's like why it's funny when you backtrack on this point or whatever, like they'll be like, oh, okay, cool. Got it. And they can just like run with it and they're going to like crush it.
I was wondering in terms of the section that you are just out in the woods, obviously that's kind of, it can be difficult, you know, particularly, obviously there's some night shots there and that, you know, was there any disasters there, or did the shoot generally go quite smooth?
I mean, the whole shoot was a disaster, but it was sure. Fine. I mean, it was not, it was a small shoot. We didn't get rained out that much, thank goodness. I think we only got rained out like 1 or 2 days. And, you know, luckily we had like good cloud cover and stuff, because you don't want it to be like too sunny, like just beating down on the actors while, you know, you're trying to get your light right and everything. I don't think anything was too crazy. We luckily had a friend of mine let us use his land. So we just kind of had all the resources we needed. Like we were just like, yeah, for this big chunk of the movie, like most of it's out in the woods. We can totally just go out there and handle this. And it was good. It was a good experience, like, because the guy had enough land that there was enough different stuff happening, like it looked different enough. Like you wouldn't want to sit through 50 minutes or whatever of a movie that all looks the same. So luckily he was like, yeah, over there there's like a pond, and over there there's like a shed, and over there there's like big trees that have fallen over, and over there's like a bunch of lily pads. So like, you know, we could film one scene at the lily pads and then like turn the camera and be like, over here is like a log, looks different enough, you know, like, yeah. So it looks like we're actually covering ground, when really we were just, you know, doing it all within like a mile, and like just knocking out pages.
I noticed right at the beginning of the film, at the various idents, one of the production companies behind the film was Paper Street Pictures. And as I've interviewed Aaron for the podcast, I was wondering how their relationship struck up there.
So I actually met him when did I first meet him? I met him through Twitter, but he basically loved the movie and wanted to help us finish it through post and everything. And he helped with some resources there. And he's basically hopped on as executive producer to just like help us get this thing out, you know? Like it was cool that he like liked it enough that he was like, oh, I'll like help you guys with this. This is great. You know, he hit me up through Twitter and was like, oh, your trailer looks awesome. Like, do you want to send me a screener? And then he was like, yeah, this movie's like awesome. I'll definitely want to put it out under our banner and like help get it out there and everything. And he's been like such a help through like post-production and everything. And yeah, that's basically how we met.
And yeah, so you premiered at the Austin Film Festival, is that right? Last year?
Yeah.
How was that, you know, in terms of that experience of seeing your first feature at a film festival?
Oh, it was fun. I had never been to Austin, I don't think. No, I had like one time for like a day, but I had never been to Austin Film Fest. I mean, that film festival is cuckoo bananas full of people. If you've never heard of it, it's like, the writers of Game of Thrones were there, the writers of what's his face, who just did his name's Craig Mazin, and he did Hangover, and he did the Russian thing on HBO, the Chernobyl. Yeah,
Chernobyl, right. Okay. Yeah,
he did those. I mean, like, there was the writer of Bill and Ted, that guy was there. He also did Men in Black, and then there was like writers from Pixar. It's mostly a writer-centered festival.
Mm-hmm.
But so there's loads of screenwriters running around, and it was really crazy to see so many different talented people from so many different disciplines, you know, because there was like people who work in animation, and then, you know, there was people who, you know, write comedies, dramas, live action. It was a great learning experience, you know, to go there and see so many people and like listen to their presentations about how to write and everything. Yeah, it was, and it was also really fun to premiere the movie there. You know, it was a great experience. We played at the Alamo Draft House, and it was fun. It was awesome.
And in terms of like your festival run after that, like this year, how much was your festival run affected by COVID, and how thankful were you that it?
Man, so, you know, I guess I'll never know how it would have been if it wasn't, or if COVID hadn't happened. Where, let me see. So we only played two physical festivals before everything became virtual. We played at Austin Film Fest, and then we played at Panic Fest. And then everything was virtual after that. And we played at Chattanooga Film Fest, Macabro, and oh crap, I'm gonna screw it up. No, we played at Fantasboa, but hold on, did we play Macabro or Morbido? This is what I'm talking about, where like I'm pretty sure I played Macabro, right? Yes, Macabro. Okay, I didn't screw it up. Okay, so yeah, we played Macabro, Fantasboa, and then we're about to do Soho Horror and Fractured Visions, and I think that's all we've done. Man, because it is, like I was saying before we started recording, it's like I don't know it, because I don't have plane tickets and I don't have to like go to the festival. Sometimes you forget it's coming up, you know what I mean? Like you, yeah, totally,
right,
like, I have no idea if I'm playing. Like, so I'll see somebody tweet about the movie and I'll be like, oh yeah, we're like, you know, playing in at Fantasboa, so like of course Brazilians are tweeting about the movie today. Like I didn't even think about it. So it's been interesting, but I you know, I kind of like it. It's certainly cheaper because I have to travel to it. Chattanooga was really, really awesome. Chattanooga, they were probably the first to do a fully virtual festival. They like teamed up with Microsoft to do it, and
they seemed to be the first that I was aware of, and then there seemed to be like a flood of festivals after that. There was like Fantasia, and then there was Fright Fest, and over here, and you know, all sorts of different ones, digital editions of things after that.
Yeah. But
Chattanooga was the first one that I was aware of that were doing a digital edition.
Yeah, so it's actually been maybe better in some ways, because you know, it somewhere like Austin or Panic Fest, which we did in person, you know, people are talking to you in person, and like that's cool when you're getting to like see people and watch the movie in a theater. But like, you know, you'd be lucky to get like four people tweeting about the movie. You know what I mean? Because people don't necessarily pull their phones out and say like, "I really like this movie. It was so funny." Like they're not gonna do that because they're already like at an event. But you know, like with Chattanooga, we were getting like 30 people tweeting about it every day. You know, like people would be tweeting about it like, you know, several times an hour, because they would all do like these live what do you call it, where you watch something and you tweet about it. Yeah, they would like
watch along.
No, there's another word, but yeah, they would do like live, I think live tweeting is what it's called. Yeah, they would do like live of the movie, so like six or seven people would all watch the movie together and be like, "Can you believe they just said that? Like, that was really funny," like quoting the movie online and stuff. And I was like, this is much more beneficial to like people hearing about the movie than, you know, playing in a theater.
It is, yeah, kind of interesting for sure. I remember when I just bought a pass for the Fright Fest Horror Film Festival here, and the same, there was another horror film festival, Grimfest, that I was at, and it was interesting how people tried to kind of replicate the festival experience kind of across Twitter. You know, it was, mm-hmm, you know, like as if, you know, it was like a bunch of people coming out of cinema and talking about a film. Like you would find it, you just finished watching the film and then you go onto Twitter and it'd be like a kind of virtual replication of that experience of like coming at the cinema and being like, "What did you think of that movie? Oh, it sucked," or "It was great, it's fucking great."
Yeah, and in some ways it probably gets you in contact with more different people, at least digitally, than you would in person. Like I always feel like at festivals, like I'm always like awkward, even if it's my movie. I don't know, like I feel weird like walking up to the bar and like buying a beer and being like, "What are you here for? What's your name?" Like it, I don't know. It's kind of a kind of a, at least for me, it's like sometimes a difficult experience to actually like come off as not a stranger.
But yeah, you know, I very much agree. You know, I'm not a particularly massively outgoing person, a little bit of an anxious person, and I tend to stick to the kind of group that I'm with at any kind of given exactly. festival that I've bought a pass for. But yeah, online, you know, you can tend to be a bit more kind of like, oh, you like that movie too, cool.
Yeah, exactly. So in some senses, it probably gets you exposed to different people, you know, that ordinarily you might not have a long conversation with if you were at the bar at Austin Film Fest or whatever. Yeah, so it's been different. That's all I can really say. Who knows what it would have been like if this hadn't happened?
Yeah, who knows? Who knows indeed? So obviously, you know, COVID has wiped out a lot of things. Are you working on a second feature, or are you just working on the day job of your various editing and shorts?
So I'm working on the day job, mostly editing. And I've been editing for, you know, a few different clients. Yeah, like you were saying about COVID, it's strange. I moved out to LA, kind of thinking, you know, I'll have to save up some money, go to LA, not work for a while, because I'll be looking for new work with new clients, hopefully, you know, picking up different work out there. But now that everybody's working from home, I've been pretty much working for all the Atlanta clients I used to work for. So I've just been in my room keeping my same job, which is cool. You know, it's good for paying rent. And then as far as working on another movie, yeah. So Brian and I have been working on pitch decks for other ideas that we have, and, you know, hoping to get to make a real movie. if that sounds ridiculous or self-effacing. I mean, it's true though, you know, we would like to get together like a lot of money. It seems like the way you do that is you have to make a bunch of pitch Bibles and things like that, and then, you know, get somebody's approval. I mean, that, you know, you have to get somebody's approval, you have to like pitch, people have to like it, all this stuff that we didn't really do on the first one. And so we're trying to do things that way, the right way. Which we didn't do the first time. We just kind of ran out because we were with the first one. We were so we'd been in some situations where we were pitching or where we were like, you know, taking important phone calls. Where, can you believe we're on the phone with this person? They like us, you know, that kind of thing based on our shorts. And then, but then it, you know, probably 90% of the time it doesn't become anything. It doesn't become anything. And sometimes you wind up with a half of a script that you don't even really like, but you were only doing it because you thought so-and-so would be involved, and now they're not involved anymore. So you don't even have anything you like at the end of the day, you know? So with this, we were like, well, let's just make something that we like, even if, cause at the end of the day, at least you'll have something you like. You'll look back and be like, well, that took a lot of time, but at least when people doubt that we can make a movie, I can show them a movie. And when they go, so what would your movie about, you know, life in a factory feel like? And I'll be like, well, it would feel like this, you know. And I can like show them, like, this is the ideal, like, what I want for tone of a movie, or like, this is, you know, this is our comedic stylings, this is what we're into. So yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what we wanted with this, and anything else that happens with it is, you know, we're over the moon about any sort of distribution we get, any sort of like placement we get on streaming services or anything like that. So yeah, so we are working on more stuff, but we're trying to do it properly. And we're trying to do it in a way that it gets more traction with those people, so it, you know, people don't flake and that person really is involved and that kind of thing.
I was wondering as well, actually, that talking about streaming services and getting on streaming services, I noticed that there was an article on RogerEbert.com about festival films that hopefully should find a home, and you were on that list. Did you see that article?
Yes, I did. Yeah, we were on that list. We at the time did not have a distribution partner, so we were, you know, a free agent, so to speak. Now we have a distribution partner that we are going to be working with, and but it doesn't mean we have they're distribution, but they're not a streaming service, so we're still going to do iTunes, Google Play, all that stuff, and then hopefully go to subscription. We'll see. I'm going to defer to them on the strategy, you know, because they're the professionals. So we'll see what they do. Yeah.
And lastly, on your kind of future projects, will you be returning to horror comedy, comedy horror, or are you looking at doing just more kind of straightforward comedy?
Man, I love comedy, but also people love horror, and horror is so fun, and there's so much, you know, there's a lot to be explored, you know, especially if you're going to do it in kind of a funny way. If you're going to come at it from a kind of comedic angle, like we were talking about Nessie, like, has there been a good Nessie movie lately?
I don't think there's ever been a good Nessie movie. There's not been that many, but no.
There was one where a guy, it wasn't a horror, but it was a guy who was trying to find Nessie. I remember watching it when I was a kid. But anyway, yeah, there's probably not a lot of great Nessie movies. You know what's another one I love is, what is it, Troll Hunter?
That's a good found footage movie. I'm not generally a big fan of found footage movies, but Troll Hunter would be high on my list of found footage movies that like.
They did Trolls, you know what I mean? Like, they found a way to make Trolls believable and scary. And I mean, I don't know, like, I'm kind of attracted to that challenge. I mean, before watching Troll Hunter, if you were like, so it's a movie where trolls are real, I'd be like, that sounds lame. You know, like, so I don't know, can we do this with fairies, mermaids? Can we make, you know, something that's like, what's a serious, a world in which we believe that like fairies are real or something, you know, like, and can it be interesting? Yes.
If you can get a particular angle on something. I'm trying to remember now, there's a Polish film that's about killer mermaids. That's really quite a fun movie, but just because you said mermaids and yeah. Now I can't remember the name of it.
It's called The Lure.
The Lure. That's it. I saw it in the film festival a couple of years back. The Lure. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fun movie.
Yeah. I mean, like, movies, I don't know. I was always a kind of person that, like, when I was in school, like, I needed a prompt for the essay. You know what I mean? Like, what's daunting is when people are like, write an essay about whatever you want. Like, you know, that's awful. But if someone can give you a prompt, like, that's there's so much more to go off of, even if what you make is just mocking the prompt itself or something. You have somewhere that your brain's gonna go. So I mean, like, I'm, you know, with mermaids or something, it's like, well, we know the general rules of mermaids. How can we either play into them or mock them or include them in the plot, or like, what can we do here, you know? So yeah, like, I'm definitely into trying to explore like those kinds of worlds. I'd love to do it again.
Well, I look forward to checking any of that out. If you make a Nessie movie or a mermaid movie, or wherever you go next, be sure to come back on the show and talk about it when you do.
Yeah, hopefully I'll be over there shooting a Nessie movie next year once COVID's done.
Cool. Well, thank you once again, Zach, for coming on the show, and be sure to do that. Be sure to say hi if you come over and make that Nessie movie.
Will do. All right, good talk.
That was my guest Zach there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I would like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of the pod. Remember, if you like what you heard, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Those 5 stars really do make a difference. So please get the New Horror Express word out there to all your friends, family, and anybody else you know. Just harass people in the street. You know, no, don't do that. Don't do that, particularly in these times. But anyway, any support you can give us would be greatly appreciated. Unfortunately, that is all for this edition of New Horror Express, but be sure to join us next time when we will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!